Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
You have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes, too, when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. Welcome, I'm Larry Mantle. Our critics this week are Christy Lemire and Angie Hahn. They'll review a documentary from former child star Soleil Moon Frye. Kid 90 focuses on child stars of the 90s. The docudrama Operation Varsity Blues combines news footage and recreations to tell the story of the college admissions scandal centered here in Southern California. Spanish writer-director Pedro Almodóvar's made his first English-language film. It's a 30-minute short starring Tilda Swinton titled The Human Voice. And Five Finger Death Punch, the group you're hearing now, is one of many rock bands highlighted in the music documentary Long Live Rock, Celebrate the Chaos. Those and more films coming up on Film Week.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at NortonSimon.org.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. I'm joined this week by Angie Hahn, film critic and deputy entertainment editor at Mashable, and Christy Lemire, film critic for RogerEbert.com and co-host of the podcast Breakfast All Day. Let me begin with thanking John Horn of KPCC, who hosted last week while I was vacationing. Great to be back with you this week, and we begin with the documentary Kid 90, the unrated doc, tells the story of Hollywood starlets who were growing up in the 1990s, full of archival footage. Angie, what do you think of Kid 90?
I was mixed on it. So this is directed by Soleil Moon Frye, who is best known for having played Punky Brewster way back then. And a lot of it is compiled of her home videos that she shot herself just growing up as a kid and as a teenager, as a child celebrity in the 1980s and 1990s. And the most obvious reason to watch this one is just for the sheer nostalgia factor. Soleil ran with this circle of other famous young actors in the 1990s. So it's just really fun to see people like Leonardo DiCaprio or Brian Austin Green just pop up in these really old candid videos. And some of that footage is woven together as well with present day interviews with Soleil herself and then some of the other people in the movie, like Brian Austin Green or Mark Paul Gosselaar or Stephen Dorff. And, you know, so there's like that celebrity gossip factor that makes it kind of an enjoyable watch. But where I think it doesn't quite work is that it wants to get into some of the deeper stuff, covering what it was like for her during that period and her issues with her body image issues, the sexual assaults that she suffered, just like a lot of deeper, darker things. And I think when she tries to get there, the documentary holds you at a bit of an arm's length. And that's not to say that she necessarily has to tell me all her secrets. I do think there's a way to explore those kinds of that kind of material without giving away all her secrets. But it just gives this movie a feel that it seems a little too polished, a little too polite, despite the fun of seeing these totally off-the-cuff home video footage clips from all these other actors.
Kid 90, the documentary. Christy.
Yeah, it ends up being kind of navel-gazing, doesn't it? And I agree with Angie that the fun of the nostalgia trip is enjoyable for about the first half. And then Soleil decides to leave Los Angeles and move to New York. And she happens to be there in the mid 90s, where then she then hangs out with like the skater street kids, some of whom ended up in the movie Kids. And so we see a lot of footage of them just partying, and it really loses its way when it becomes about that. And then, you know, she directed it and she also is interviewed in it throughout. And so it just feels, it feels very small and kind of a vanity project in a lot of ways. She, in a very superficial way, talks about all these lives that were lost, all these young people who were trying to express their pain, their trauma, their sense of isolation, and they ended up ODing or committing suicide. And she says that in looking back at these videos now, she has perspective of they were crying out and I didn't hear it. And I appreciate the sentiment behind that, but the way that she actually expresses it feels kind of rushed, kind of surface, and ultimately it feels about, it's about her. It's just about her, and it doesn't have the deeper cultural exploration that this opportunity could have offered.
We're talking about the documentary Kid 90, directed by Soleil Moon Frye. It's unrated and it's on the Hulu streaming service. The documentary Operation Varsity Blues, the college admission scandal, is not a pure doc. It also has recreations that are included along with archival news footage of the college admission scandal. Chris Smith is the director. Christy?
I liked this, and I liked the ambition of it, and I liked the weird hybrid of it. And so if you are a purist about your documentaries and you want just facts and journalism, this might be a little frustrating for you, because while you do have a lot of meaty, juicy facts here as far as what went down with the college admissions scandal, it's depicted with actors playing the roles of these parents who were trying to fudge their kids' way into USC or Harvard or wherever. And starting with Matthew Modine, starring as Rick Singer. And he's got the little monk-like Caesar haircut, the silver bowl cut, and he's walking around in his, you know, basketball coach athleisure all the time. And you know, you see him going from being a local college prep guy in Sacramento to really having his sights set on a much more lavish and much more celebrity kind of driven life. So what this is based on are, you know, wiretap phone calls that the FBI had between Rick Singer and all these wealthy parents, and actors act them out. And I enjoyed it. It moves really well. Chris Smith, who directed this, also was one of the executive producers behind Tiger King a year ago, which seems like a lifetime ago, but it was only a year ago.
Wow.
And right. And also he did one of the Fyre Festival documentaries, the one that aired on Netflix. And so he's got a really good handle on like what makes something a juicy, scandalous story that we can't get enough of, but then it is rooted in fact and it is rooted in truth. And I enjoyed it.
Operation Varsity Blues, the college admission scandal. Angie.
Yeah, I quite liked it too. The reenactments were going in, the reenactments were what I was afraid wouldn't really work, but I think they do work, and they really do paint a more vivid picture of what happened than just an endless series of people reading transcripts would have. And Christy's right, this was a really juicy, scandalous story at the time. It made headlines, but one of the things I appreciated about this documentary is that he doesn't try to over-sensationalize what was already a pretty sensational story. He's not interested in just framing it as like, oh, here's this hot gossip that I have. And nor does he give into the temptation to pin this all on Rick or just make him this sort of like enormous evil mastermind. Instead, the point that he emphasizes, and where I think the documentary is the most interesting, is when it's exploring how the scandal is a symptom, not the cause, of this larger rot within elite college admissions. So he has, for example, test prep experts talking about how standardized testing is in itself this massive industry that just perpetuates this class divide where rich people can afford to pay for test prep so they get better scores and so on and so forth. So watching it, you realize what Singer and the parents did was wrong, of course, but the documentary does a good job of outlining the culture of education and wealth that made some of these parents feel like they quote unquote had to do this, and even made some of the school officials feel like they quote unquote had to play along with Singer. So on the whole, it feels like a movie where you come in for the drama of reliving this massive scandal and reliving a lot of the kind of schadenfreude that we felt at the time. But then you come away thinking maybe a little bit differently about not just the scandal itself, but the systems that gave rise to it.
Operation Varsity Blues, the college admission scandal, a docudrama, I guess you'd call it. It's rated R from director Chris Smith, and it's streaming starting next Wednesday on Netflix. The drama The Inheritance is set in the early 90s in West Philadelphia. Angie, tell us about it, please.
This is a movie about a young man named Julian, played by Eric Lockley, who inherits his grandmother's house in West Philadelphia and turns it into a collective for Black activists and artists. And right away, it feels like a movie that is marching to the beat of its own drummer, by which I mean the first shot is of a sheet of paper and it goes on so long that I thought something was wrong with my screener. But that kind of sense of playfulness and this disinterest in convention continues throughout the movie. It blends this narrative drama about this guy trying to build collective with archival footage of like the Move Africa group or Shirley Chisholm's presidential campaign, and with some interviews and talks that seem like they're kind of both at once. And I do feel like it's not going to be everyone's cup of tea. This formal inventiveness can be a little bit distancing at times, and it can get a while to get into the rhythms of this movie. And it doesn't hold your hand as it walks you through a lot of this political history. But there's just such creative energy and warmth flowing throughout the movie and no small amount of humor. So overall, I really enjoyed this one. I thought it was really unique.
The Inheritance. What do you think, Christy?
Definitely not everyone's cup of tea, but I so admired the playfulness of its structure. It owes a lot of its tone and its structure to Jean-Luc Godard, in that it is really self-aware of its intellectualism and its formality, but then it will play with like words on the screen and it will find some whimsy here and there. It will alternate between really heady philosophical debates about the Black experience, about civil rights, but then you'll also see these folks sitting around a table arguing about the schedule on whose day is it to do the dishes. So it's a hodgepodge of different kinds of experience, high and low, serious and playful, and not unlike Operation Varsity Blues, and not unlike a couple of different other films we're going to talk about today, it does have this mixture of fiction and reality and a blurring of the two and an alternating between the two, because, you know, these are fictional characters, but they are talking about the writings and the activism of real people who lived and fought hard to make change. And so it's sort of a heady mix of stuff that is very educational.
It's written and directed by Ephraim Asili in his feature directorial debut. The Inheritance is unrated, and you can see it on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. Also on this week's Film Week, The Human Voice. It's a Spanish short film starring Tilda Swinton and written and directed by one of my favorites, Pedro Almodovar. Christy.
Oh, I love this so much. And I hope that there are a lot of ways to see it. I know it is playing theatrically, but I'm hoping that also it will be out there streamable. This is a 30-minute short. This is Almodovar's first English language film, but it is every inch through and through an Almodovar film. And Tilda Swinton is perfect as his muse here. If he's going to have someone doing an English language film for him, she is perfectly in the mold of the melodramatic, larger-than-life, fantastical, statuesque presence of women that have, you know, led his films for so long. This is based on a play by Jean Cocteau, also called The Human Voice, about a woman who is waiting for her lover to return. His bags are packed, the dog is waiting, and she's just wondering where he is. He hasn't called, he hasn't shown up, and she's going increasingly mad. And you realize that she is not really in an apartment. She is in a set that looks like an apartment. And it looks exactly like the apartment that Antonio Banderas lives in Pain and Glory. So the production design, the colors, the decor, the fantastic wardrobe that Tilda Swinton wears in this, it's full of drama and heartache, but truth. Like within a half an hour, it packs in such sorrow, and the dog is really good too. So there's this simultaneously a formality here, but also a warmth. And there's like a claustrophobia to it. but also a great deal of feeling, of true sadness and feeling. And I just loved it. So I hope folks can find a way to get to it.
And I understand it's Almodovar's first English language film.
It is crazy, which, yeah, he's been around forever. And Tilda Swinton is a fantastic person to lead that. She is the whole thing. It's essentially like a half an hour long monologue. But she does also go out to a hardware store to buy a hatchet. And that's all I'm going to say.
Okay. We're talking about The Human Voice, a 30-minute short film from Spanish writer-director Pedro Almodovar. And I can't ever remember a standalone short being at a drive-in, but that's exactly right. You can see it at the Vineland Drive-In in the City of Industry. The Human Voice is rated R. Also out this week, the documentary Long Live Rock, Celebrate the Chaos, directed by Jonathan McHugh. Angie?
Well, this is a documentary about modern rock music. And when I say it's a documentary about modern rock music, I mean it's a documentary about all things modern rock music. This movie is trying to cover so much ground, from the fan community to racism and sexism within the industry to mental health among musicians, that it ends up super shallow, which is not to say it's without its charms. It can be pretty likable at times. If nothing else, it really made me miss concerts. And it features interviews with both a bunch of really charismatic fans and a lot of famous rock stars, plus a lot of concert footage. So I think that moment to moment, it can be kind of a nice watch. But one thing I kept coming back to was just, who is this movie for? What is this trying to say? And I could not for the life of me figure it out. I kind of feel like people who know a lot about rock music and are already invested in it and like rock music aren't going to find anything in here that they don't already know. And people who are less invested or don't know as much won't come away with any better understanding of what rock is or what makes it special, what sets it apart from other genres or communities. So I think in the broadest sense, it's just trying to celebrate this genre at a time when its popularity has waned a bit and been overtaken by other genres like rap and pop. And you can tell that the filmmaker really does have such a strong affection for the music. But it's such a broad directive, you know, trying to celebrate rock, that it's basically meaningless. And it goes, it kind of meanders a lot. It goes on a lot of detours. I right. just have no idea what it's doing.
Long Live Rock, Celebrate the Chaos is unrated. It's on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. We'll continue with Angie Hahn and Christy Lemire, our critics this week. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC, the KPECC app, and your podcast platform as well.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
It's Film Week on KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up in just a few minutes, we have an excerpt from our first virtual Film Week event, Film Week and Chill, we call the series, and The Incredibles I chose as the inaugural film. Our critics Claudia Puig and Charles Solomon joined me for the online event a couple of weeks ago. Also with me, the director and writer of the film, Brad Bird, and composer for The Incredibles, Michael Giacchino. It was a wonderful night. If you have not seen it, it is available for you to see the full hour in its entirety. Just go to kpcc.org/in-person. Also, we'll be keeping you up to date on future Film Week and Chill events. We'll have our other critics who'll be joining us for those, as well as some of the principals from those films. This devoted just to fun films in this very trying time of the pandemic. We're not doing the LA-centric films like our live events at the Theater at Ace Hotel. We'll get back to those once we can gather again in person. But this Film Week and Chill, like the title indicates, we're just doing light stuff, and we began with The Incredibles. So we have much more to come in that series. Let's continue with this week's reviews. Come True is a Canadian sci-fi horror film that's written and directed by Anthony Scott Burns, Julia Sarah Stone, and Landon Lebaron star in the film. Christy.
I really dug this movie for a long time, and it's this very trippy horror movie about a young woman played by Julia Sarah Stone, who is kind of at sea. She's kind of lost. She's kind of not living at home. She's about 18 years old. She's in high school, and she keeps just nodding off in the middle of class. Like, she's just off. And she sees a flyer for a sleep study that pays to watch you sleep and see what's happening in your dreams. And so she agrees to do that. And what becomes clear between what is manifesting itself in her subconscious and then the other people who are in the other beds is that they're all kind of seeing a version of the same thing. And in its simplicity, it is absolutely terrifying what they all see. It's kind of vague and kind of blurry, but unmistakable in its menace. And as we get deeper into it, it gets more and more terrifying. They accomplish so much here with what I have to imagine must have been a pretty low budget, just with editing and lighting and the score, just to really put you on edge and just to amp up that feeling as you're going along. Julia Sarah Stone has this sort of haunting presence about her. She's very pale and skinny and has these big blue eyes and kind of the shock of platinum blonde hair that's very short. She kind of reminded me of Madonna during her True Blue phase. But she's got a really striking presence about her, and she's got a great face for horror. And then something happens at the end that kind of changes everything you just saw. And I walked away from it going, really? Like, did we have to do this? Does that even work? And so I wish they had just like left it alone, but I dug it for a long time.
So you felt kind of sold itself out at the end?
There's something that happens at the end that kind of changes everything that came before it. And I did not think it was necessary.
All right. I won't push because we don't want to spoil it.
Nope.
We're talking about Come True. I wonder if Anthony Scott Burns, who wrote and directed it, worked as a tech in a sleep lab, if that was where he got the idea. Angie, what'd you think of Come True?
I am a little cooler on it than Christy was, but I agree with a lot of what she says. It does a lot with just stuff like the lighting and the score. And I, too, was kind of really into it for a while. You know, it's paced really well at first in terms of the mystery. So you're on the hook waiting for like each new reveal and really eager to see what's going to happen. But it lost me earlier than it lost Christy. It takes a turn about halfway through when it detours into this totally unnecessary and ill-advised romantic storyline. And it never really recovers from there. That's the point at which I started to suspect this is not going to go anywhere that I care about. And sadly, I was right. And I think a huge part of it has to do with how the leads were written. I do think the performances are fine. I don't think that's the real problem. But like Sarah's ostensibly the protagonist, but the film never gets around to giving her much of a perspective or personality or much agency. And then meanwhile, there's this other character, a doctor, named Jeremy, and I don't think he comes across the way the movie wants him to come across, and that becomes a huge problem as he takes more and more of an active role in the plot, and the movie seems to want you to feel a certain way about him. And then, of course, there is the twist ending that Christy mentioned, which is really more just like a series of twists piled on top of each other, none of which are very well set up. Each one is sillier and more obnoxious than the last, and at the end, you're just like, well, okay, that was that.
Come True, the sci-fi horror film from Canada. Anthony Scott Burns, the writer-director, Julia Sarah Stone stars. It's unrated at the Vineland Drive-In in Industry and available on demand over Google Play and Vudu. The documentary Own the Room follows five international students as they compete to win the Global Student Entrepreneur Awards in Macau, China. Christy.
This is a totally fascinating contrast with Operation Varsity Blues, because these are young people who are total go-getters, who work really, really hard, who are deeply invested in these business startups or ideas for gadgets or whatever it is that is like their business that they want to launch. And they have put in the hours and the sweat and the tears, and it's the total opposite of the kids whose parents bought their way in by pretending that they were on the rowing team or whatever. So this is from Christina Costantini, is one of the directors here. She also previously did the Walter Mercado documentary that we talked about last year, Mucho, Mucho Amor. And there is as much affection here for these kids and their aspirations and inspirations and what they can contribute to the world. It's a very feel-good movie. And you follow all these kids who are the winners of their own countries, sort of like Shark Tank. It's like Shark Tank for kids. And then every level that you go up, you get, you know, the possibility of greater prize money and investment into your idea. And you come to root, sort of like the movie Spellbound, how you follow all the kids in the spelling bee. You come to root for various kids as you get to know their family and their country and what their life is like. And so you have kids from Nepal and Puerto Rico. There's a young woman who is originally from Venezuela who comes to New York to get her PhD at NYU and competes as a student from the United States. And her idea is truly, truly groundbreaking. And it's just really inspiring. It makes me have hope for the future.
Own the Room is streaming on Disney Plus. It's unrated, directed by Christina Costantini and Darren Foster. Also, this week on Film Week, Yes Day, a family comedy starring Jennifer Garner and Edgar Ramirez. Miguel Arteta is the director. Justin Mullen is the screenwriter of the film, which is based on a book by Amy Krauss Rosenthal. Yes Day, Angie.
Yeah, I thought this was a pretty sweet and cute comedy about this uptight mom, Allison, played by Jennifer Garner, who gives her family a yes day where the parents have to say yes to anything the kids want to do, which I had never heard of, but is apparently a real thing. And there's a germ of some interesting ideas here about how Allison's self-identity and self-image have really changed since she became a parent, and also some stuff about her relationship with her husband, who basically is the parent that is more permissive because he knows that she's going to always be the one that has to say no and be the bad guy. And then for a second, I did wonder if the movie was going to get into more of that, especially given that Arteta, his other movies like Beatrice at Dinner or The Good Girl have not shied away from the spikier stuff. But I was wrong. It doesn't really go into that. It is largely just this bright, shiny comedy about this family doing crazy fun stuff like gorging on ice cream and going to Six Flags. And on that level, it's not bad. I mean, Jennifer Garner is famously likable, and she's very likable here. All the actors are, really, which I think smooths over the fact that sometimes these people are being low-key jerks, but that's fine. You want them to be happy, if only because there's no reason to not want that for them. And they do make the Yes Day itself look really fun, to the point where I would not show this movie to a kid unless you were planning to give them a Yes Day, because they are going to want one after they see this. So, yeah. I mean, on that level, it works. I just don't think that there's anything that much there. It's very, you know, it's like cotton candy, just kind of sweet, goes down easy, but is insubstantial.
Yes Day is rated PG. Christy.
So I watched Yes Day with my own child, who is 11. I have never actually heard of Yes Days, but yes, my child now wants a Yes Day, and now that he knows that Yes Days might be a thing. It is cute and it is light. I liked it better in the beginning when it was rooted in more of a recognizable depiction of family life, of everyone dashing off somewhere. The casting of Edgar Ramirez is a little weird to me, just because I never thought of him as somebody who would do something kind of light and goofy like this. He's a serious actor, and I mean, he was Gianni Versace in the American Horror Story. Like, he does like serious stuff, and I never thought like, I want to cast him as the wacky pratfalling dad in a made for Netflix movie. But they have okay chemistry with each other. It gets really over the top. It gets very, very silly, and you know, the house gets trashed and things are all over the top, but it is harmless. My kid is cynical and has seen a lot more movies than most kids, so he was like, oh, it's lame. But I think for much younger kids who laugh at silly stuff, they might enjoy it.
You did that very well.
So lame.
That's very small. Yes Day is rated PG from director Miguel Arteta. Jennifer Garner and Edgar Ramirez star. It is streaming on Netflix. The sci-fi action movie Cosmic Sin stars Frank Grillo and Bruce Willis. Edward Drake is the director and co-screenwriter. Christy.
This is the movie that inspired me to begin my worst of the year list. Every year I keep track as the year goes on of like possible best and worst of contenders, and like, yep, it's time. Cosmic Sin is my inspiration. So Bruce Willis, you guys, keeps making these like terrible, schlocky action movies, and he shows up and like kind of mumbles his lines and kind of like sleepwalks his way through it. It doesn't seem like he's very interested in being there. To suggest that he is phoning it in here would be an insult to telephone communication, which can actually be an effective way of conveying emotion and information. It's the year 2524, but Earth still kind of looks like it does now, except we have robot bartenders, and of course we have flying cars, as all futuristic sci-fi movies must. And there's been some sort of contact with another alien civilization on some other planet, and so a bunch of, or supposedly the elite soldiers and scientists must quantum leap their way to this planet to obliterate them before they can come to Earth. They might be alien zombies, which is not nearly as fun as it sounds. This movie looks terrible. The performances are all totally stiff. It's just the editing and the lighting. It just looks really, really cheap. It is never, ever suspenseful. It's never exciting. And I just don't know what Bruce Willis is doing here. Like, there's no way the man needs a paycheck this badly.
The movie is Cosmic Sin, directed by Edward Drake. It's rated R. It's at the Cine Lounge Drive-In in Hollywood and on demand Fandango Now, iTunes, and Vudu. And finally this week, real briefly, we'll look at the romantic comedy Long Weekend, starring Finn Wittrock, Zoe Chow, and Damon Wayans Jr., Stephen Bazelon, the writer-director. Angie, real briefly on this.
It is a manic pixie dream girl romance, which is a little bit annoying because the characters specifically call it out in the dialogue and insist that that's not what it is, but it is, which doesn't seem like something I would like, but Finn Wittrock and Zoe Chow, I think, have good enough chemistry and the writing is strong enough that you really do believe the affection that these people have for each other. And I think that did a lot to, it carried this movie a long way for me in terms of liking it overall, even as I kind of rolled my eyes at some of the cheesier bits.
It's set in LA. Does it give you that sense of place?
It does. It's set in LA. It feels like it's set in LA. And it reminded me superficially of Wander Darkly, another movie that we saw last year that was a romance with a big twist that was set in Los Angeles and just has a beautiful character shuttling from one LA location to another.
We're talking about Long Weekend, the romantic comedy from writer-director Stephen Bazelon. It's his feature directorial debut. Christy, what did you think?
This movie is super annoying. It's so cutesy. Yes, the fact that it is self-referential in its manic pixie dream girlishness is actually more annoying than it is charming. They don't get off the hook by doing that. That's actually just obnoxious. I guess they have an okay chemistry with each other, and it's shot in quite a lovely way. But the thing that you suspect is the deal with her is indeed the deal with her. But then they want to have it both ways, or maybe the twist is not really a twist. Anyway, it's not nearly as clever as it thinks it is.
The film, once again, is Long Weekend, romantic comedy, rated R. You can see it at the Vineland Drive-In in the City of Industry. And I know this wasn't one you were excited to talk about, Angie, but it's just such a weird premise, the horror comedy Slacks.
Yes, so that is a horror comedy set in one of those quote-unquote ethical fast fashion stores about a pair of jeans that magically comes to life and starts killing people. So that's an interesting premise, which is why yeah. I was like, I have to check this out. And the film does have fun with it, with like weird visuals of the pants crawling around and drinking up blood and like wrapping themselves around someone's throat. So
tough stains
so
to get out of jeans.
Yeah.
Slacks, the film is unrated. It's on the Shudder streaming service starting next week. We have coming up an excerpt of our Film Week and Chill first event on The Incredibles with the writer-director Brad Bird, composer Michael Giacchino, two of our Film Week critics coming right up. It's Film Week on KPCC. Well, sadly, the pandemic forced us to press pause on our LA-centric screening series at the Theater at Ace Hotel. But the good news is we've started a virtual series called Film Week and Chill. We'll bring together a group of people to talk about different beloved movies. We kicked off the series with one of my favorites, The Incredibles. Director Brad Bird and composer Michael Giacchino joined along with our own critics, Claudia Puig and Charles Solomon. Here's part of that conversation.
Brad Bird, thank you for joining us. How'd you come up with the idea for the family of superheroes?
Well, it started with another project where I had a sort of a fantastical character that was past his prime. And then I started thinking about what if a superhero was past his prime? And at the time, I was trying to break into movies. I was working on The Simpsons, but I was really trying to get into movies. And I had all this anxiety. I also had a new family. And I had all this anxiety of being bad at either being a dad or not being able to get into the movie business. In other words, if I got a break in the movie business, if I threw myself into it completely, I might be a bad dad. And if I was a good father, then how could I give the movie attention it deserves? So that pull between work and family is definitely in the film.
Well, and also the sensibility of the film, the era, it's like 60s futuristic. Where did that idea come from?
When you experience something as a child, it kind of sears its way into your DNA. And that's everything I thought was cool when I was a kid. I thought Johnny Quest was cool. I thought James Bond was cool. I thought the music was cool. I thought the clothes were cool. The gadgets were cool. The enemies were cool. And so this was kind of all of that put together.
Michael Giacchino, thank you for being with us. So when you and Brad first talked about the idea for this and the sound of The Incredibles, how did Brad describe what he was looking for?
Well, I remember when I went up to Pixar for the first time, which was a really strange experience because, you know, I was going into this place that I didn't have a job. I didn't have the job yet. I was just going to meet Brad, and they were going to show me some clips from the film, and then Brad and I were going to talk about it. And I remember very specifically, you know, we started talking about animation because I'm a huge animation nerd. I love it so much. It was actually one of the things I wanted to be as a kid was an animator. But we started talking about animation, and then Johnny Quest came up in the conversation, and we were supposed to be there talking about The Incredibles and what this could mean and what is this, how important this job could be, blah, blah, blah. We just like went on this tangent about Johnny Quest and how much we love Johnny Quest. And then we started talking about Hoyt Curtin, who wrote the music for Johnny Quest, and how much I loved him and how much Brad loved him. And we just immediately hit it off, and it was really fun. And Brad's like, well, that's what I want this to sound like. I want this to sound like that. And I'll never forget, one of the things he said was, I want kids running out of this theater, like screaming this theme song, you know, and pretending that they're these people from this movie. So we need to give them that energy that shows like Johnny Quest, James Bond, Henry Mancini stuff, all of that. You know, we wanted to just take all those things he and I both love, mash them all together.
And Michael, let's listen to that, because you were kind enough to invite me to one of the days of the scoring session at Sony Studios. This was for Incredibles 2, but the music, of course, very similar to what was in the first film. Let's listen to this take on the closing credits. So there you get. So that's just my phone recording it, but the energy, the power you were talking about, it's there.
Well, and you know what? Why that is? It's because everyone in the orchestra is there in that room playing together. You know, nowadays they do this thing called tracking, and they record everyone separately, and it does, you know, it can have a good effect to some extent, but it misses that sort of soul that happens, that thing that happens when everyone is together doing something. And that just made me really miss it. We haven't done that in well over a year now because of everything. But yeah, that's amazing.
Claudia Puig, I want to ask you about the characters in the film, the voice performances, the characterizations. One of the things I love about this is how much we identify with characters that are superheroes.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, and I think we identify with it at least one and possibly more. You know, everyone's been a kid or been an awkward, you know, teenager, embarrassed. And I particularly loved the Helen character. Holly Hunter's voice was so great. And I just felt like she was such a multidimensional developed character. And we see so few of women in any kind of movie, animated or live action, that are really well developed. So she was like my favorite character. But everybody got to have their moment too. It was like everybody in the family, you know, even down to Jack-Jack. I mean, everybody, it was such a ensemble piece. And I love the characters.
Well, and the clip that we showed, you know, with her arm stretching around the table to grab it, what mom doesn't in some way, you know, relate to that?
You're stretched thin, right? You're stretched and you're trying to do a million things. And that's the thing that's so great about that character too, is that she's, you know, grounded, she's smart, she's funny, she's capable. That thing she says where she, you know, like women can save the world or whatever, the very beginning when she's being interviewed. She just reaches out and handles everything. She's so great. I love her.
Charles, I wanted to ask you about the look of the Incredibles characters, because this was a big breakthrough for Pixar.
Well, The Incredibles is not only a good film and one that I like very much, having been following Brad since Amazing Stories, but it is a very important film, really a watershed film in animation history. This is when Brad and his artists showed that the way to bring CG characters to life on the screen is not to make them more realistic, as they had tried to do in films like Shrek and the early Toy Stories, where you get these kind of waxworks automatons that are so creepy, but rather to look back to the classic animation of Disney and Warner Brothers. By making them cartoonier, they come to life in a way that no human character had in CG before. And since then, everyone has copied it, and not just the artists at Pixar learning from him, Disney, DreamWorks, Blue Sky, everybody copied The Incredibles the way they used to copy the old Disney silly symphonies, that this is what we learn from. Here's how to do it. This works. And it's a groundbreaking film in that sense.
Also want to talk about Brad's previous film to this, The Iron Giant, which is to me a classic film, but it was not a box office success, despite what a great film it was artistically. But that, of course, a 2D film. And here Brad takes on the challenge of, you know, doing the tech conversion to 3D computer animation.
Well, The Iron Giant himself was CG. The humans weren't. But that was a film that broke all the critics and animators' hearts, because we said, this could be our Dumbo. This is the movie we wanted to make. This is the movie audiences said they want to see. Why isn't anybody going to it?
Yeah, Brad, that had to be extremely disheartening, coming out of a film that's that great, but the audience doesn't come out to see it. Where were you creatively and career-wise coming out of that film?
I have a different viewpoint of it now, because I think part of the reason we were able to do what we did is because the studio really wasn't paying attention to us, which was great in many ways. As long as we stayed on a very tight budget, which was very hard, they kind of let us make the movie.
More about Film Week and Chill in our conversation to come, as we hear more about The Incredibles right after this.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
How to LA is our love letter to Los Angeles. We'll tell you where to get a yummy torta, a bowl of congee, and of course, a burger.
It's a beef sausage blend, fried egg, grilled onions, and then raspberry jam.
What hiking trails to check out.
This feels like we're out in the mountains.
And where to take in some culture.
Limerick Park, they've been fostering jazz for decades.
LA's a big place with a lot going on, so we got you. Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. It's Film Week and Chill, our new series of virtual events with our critics and filmmakers. Our first installment featuring one of my favorites, The Incredibles. Let's get right back to the conversation. We begin with this clip featuring supersuit designer Edna Mode.
Yes, things are going quite well, my God, no complaints. But, you know, it is not the same at all.
Weren't you just in the news, some show in Prague?
Milan, darling, Milan. Supermodels. Nothing super about them, spoiled, stupid little stick figures with poofy lips who think only about themselves. I used to design for gods. But perhaps you come with a challenge, eh? I was surprised to get your call.
I just need a patch job.
This is mega mesh, outmoded, but very sturdy, and you've torn right through it. What have you been doing, Robert? Moonlighting hero work?
Must have happened a long time ago.
I see. This is a hobo suit, darling. Oh, you can't be seen in this. I won't allow it. 15 years ago, maybe, but now...
What do you mean? You designed it.
I never look back, darling. It distracts from the now.
Claudia, I want to ask you about Edna Mode, because when I saw the screening at the El Capitan for the first time, the audience just laughed so heartily. That character... even if people were not familiar with who Edith Head was or, you know, big Hollywood designers, they understood what that character represents.
I love her. I love that. I remember I went back and looked at my review of the movie. And one of the things I said was, Edna needs her own spinoff. And I would like to see a full movie. I know there's been a short that Brad didn't direct, but just the eccentricities. I love that, because I kept trying to place the accent, and I'm going, is it German, is it Japanese? And I think I read somewhere that it was both. Is that right, Brad?
Yeah, Brad, how did you find the voice artist for that role?
Well, it was the only one that was really cheap and really available all the time. So.
Seriously, how did you end up doing it yourself?
Well, I would fall into that voice when I was describing her to people, and I went to I actually went to Lily Tomlin and met with her, and she was going to record it, but. She kept asking me to do the voice again, like, tell me how it goes again. And then she asked me to record the entire part into her tape recorder and leave it, which I thought was very strange. And so I did. And she called the next week and she said, I've been working at it, but I think you do it better. And right at the same time, we had internal screenings. And both John Lasseter and Andrew Stanton, the other directors at Pixar and creative heads of Pixar, said that I should do the voice. And so I just said, okay, you know, I mean, it's weird, but okay, you know, and there you go. There it is.
We have Christian, who is joining us from Atlanta. Christian, thanks very much. Question for you, Michael. Wondering what challenge you faced when composing the score for the sequel.
It was funny because for a long time, and Brad will tell you this, I was like, no, don't make a sequel. That's it. Boom, you're done. You did that. It's great. Why do we always have to have like 2, 3, 4 of everything? You know, let's just make one good thing. Part of me doing that was that I was afraid to kind of go back and try and jump into those shoes again. I mean, that was my first movie that I did. And as much fun as I had, it was also, you know, somewhat traumatizing at the time. Some part in due to Brad, because when I first got the job, we were on the phone and he was like, all right, you know, you got the job. And I was like, really? He goes, yeah, yeah, you got the job. You know, it's gone. I was like, oh man, thank you. That's so great. I'm so excited. He goes, hold on, hold on. I just want to say one thing. And he goes, your music could ruin my movie. I was like, I'm like,
no pressure.
I'm like, yeah. Wait, what, is this a job? Didn't you say I got the job? Anyway, he goes, now what I mean by that is that if your music is not in lockstep with my story, then the audience is going to start thinking things that we don't want them to think. They're going to start, their mind's going to go places we don't want it to go. So you and I have to be hand in hand this whole time, no matter what. It's always about the story, which I was a huge believer of anyway, coming up to this point. But it was such a great thing to hear, actually, because it's been ringing through my head ever since. And so coming back to the second movie, I thought of that. And I remember thinking like, okay, lockstep with the story. And of course, that movie was slightly different production schedule. It was a little more crazy because it had to get done in a much shorter time period than the first one did.
Jen in Emeryville, wondering for Brad, how you came up with all of Jack's powers in the first film and then expanded on them in the second.
Well, the idea behind that, very quickly, is like the rest of the family, where you go with archetypes, and men are the heads of the families. When men are the heads of the families, they're always expected to be strong. Mother figures are pulled many different ways at once, and are kings of multitasking. So having her stretch was good. You know, teenagers are insecure, so her powers are invisibility. Babies are unknowns. They could possibly be imbued with more powers than have ever been seen before. So I had Jack be a polymorph, meaning that his body sort of hasn't decided what his powers are yet. You know, the fact that babies, you can put them in a deep end of a pool and they know how to swim because they haven't forgotten the inside of the womb, and they can grasp languages very quickly. And there's just something, you know, amazingly versatile about babies. So that was the idea. And when I had the first film, I needed, if it got too plot heavy, I needed something to cut to spark things up. And I thought leaving that kind of baby with a babysitter would be something to cut to. But when we filled out the story that we were doing had so much momentum by itself that I didn't need to cut to the babysitter. So we ended up doing the babysitter as a little extra film that went onto the DVD. And so I had this unexploded bomb of Jack that the family didn't know about. The audience knew about his multiple powers, but they didn't. And that was a big sort of thing in the second movie.
Charles, closing thought from you.
Well, with Incredibles, Ratatouille, and Iron Giant, Brad has made three of the great animated films, and that's not of his generation, of the last decades. 80 years later, we're still talking about Pinocchio and Dumbo and Bambi. And I think in 80 years, people will still be talking about The Iron Giant and Incredibles and Ratatouille because they are great films and great animated films.
My thanks to director Brad Bird, composer Michael Giacchino, and our terrific Film Week critics Charles Solomon and Claudia Puig. Our first Film Week and Chill virtual event. You can see the whole thing, the video of it and all. It's available at kpcc.org on our Film Week page. You can also see it by going to kpcc.org/in-person, where you'll get updates on our future ones as well. Have a great weekend.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidiots and Eagle Rock, amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA wherever you listen to podcasts.